Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 5 of the 2QB Experience. This is the Joe Flacco Experience. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Joshua Lake. Josh, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing well. Glad to be back and surviving all the rain down here in Houston.
Yeah, I heard that you had to battle J.J. Watt in a canoe just to get home today.
Just pushing people out of the way. He had to get in the workout room.
Well, we also have a special guest for this episode. You know him from NFL.com, Football Guys, the creator of Reception Perception, Backyard Banter podcast, which is excellent. Dogfather to Sir Charles, Charlie, the one and only, the young, the restless, Matt Harmon. How you doing, Matt?
Yeah, thanks, guys, for having me. This is definitely a very fitting intro there, especially the part about Charlie. That is my most important title, after all.
Yep, I'm a dog father myself, just like Snoop, and it's a good time. Like, it's a constant source of entertainment, isn't it?
It really is. We were just actually out on a little walk beforehand, and we ran into one of our neighbors and had a nice little chat. She asked me about his backstory, and I'm like, oh well, I'm gonna sit down and tell you. I don't know if you know, but you're talking to a minor internet celebrity here.
Yeah, well, let's keep things going because I got to get out and walk my dog sooner rather than later. We got one quick question for you first, Matt, and actually Josh discovered this, so I'm going to let him ask you about it here. It has to do with NFL.com itself.
So this is amazing to me. This is probably the best thing I have found in fantasy internet, that NFL.com/garbage links to everything you've written for the site. That is a true story. I couldn't believe it when you first linked that, and I would love to hear the backstory on how NFL.com/garbage became linked to you.
Yeah, this is fun because nobody's actually there are a few people on Twitter that know about it, but I've never I will never link out to it because I don't want to get in trouble for it. Like if somebody from work actually saw it, but like if I'm talking with one of you guys, I'll occasionally drop that joke out there. But it is a funny story because this was about a month after I first got there. Backstory first, like this is not a quick question, but but backstory first, like obviously being, you know, myself, Marcus Grant, Matt Franciscovich, Alex Gelhar, we all do all the editing for the fantasy page. And so we have access to, you know, vanity URLs. So if I wanted to make NFL.com/, you know, my sophomore wide receiver series had a vanity URL, like to actually collect all the content in one page so that you can just type in NFL.com/wide receivers and it would go to one of my articles. And so you can easily promote it on podcasts, that sort of stuff. But so I think it was about a month after I got there, and I quickly gained a reputation for writing much longer than everybody else, which is, if you read my stuff, you're not surprised. I do go into a lot of detail about things. So I blasted out, you know, my 15 guys that were under the radar in drafts, and Gelhard says, all right, let me quick edit this latest Harmon Garbo piece or whatever. And somehow it just, you know, stuck that I was all my, like, basically anytime I'd send something, I'd be like, all right, let's just edit this latest piece of garbage from Harmon because I can take that sort of abuse. So at one point, you know, the guys were just like, all right, we're just going to make your home page, your author page, NFL.com/garbage. And it would be like a little inside joke between us and like some of the readers. You know, some people know about it, some people don't. But yeah, it's just a little editorial privilege right there. And it is very funny that, yeah, I'm just typing in the garbage and that's what goes right to my author page. I am the garbage content creator of NFL.com.
It is far from true, but I still laugh every time I find that.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, I know that obviously I'm not saying this to like toot my own horn, but obviously like I know I'm not terrible at this, and that the guys don't think that either. So it's just, it's fun to laugh at. And it's one of those little things, breaks the monotony of the day to day editing grind.
Yeah, man. Got to have some garbage men to take out the trash every once in a while. Moving on here, I want to talk a little bit about an article at 2QBs.com. Selfish plug, this one is one of mine. I called it Breaking the Game, X's and O's. It's generally about how you can apply strategy from other sorts of games to fantasy football. I'll let you read the piece for a full in-depth, you know, look at tic-tac-toe and how I think that applies to fantasy. But I wanted to get your guys' take on some of your favorite or more interesting games that you've played that aren't fantasy and how those games have informed your fantasy opinions. Josh, do you want to kick this off?
Sure, I'm really looking forward to seeing where the series goes. I think it's an interesting way to look at fantasy is to bring in strategies from other genres. I definitely grew up as a gamer playing way too many video games, and I still do on occasion, but now with a kid, it's more teaching him to play. And so just thinking about it in terms of video games, one of the things that came to mind with your piece is that video games have taught me that there's usually many ways to win, and it's finding the one that you're best at. It's not that there is only one path to the finish in most games or to the best outcome. There's a lot. And so learning to leverage your strengths and find players or find characters or whatever it may be that fit you is really the best path to success. That was kind of the thing that came to mind as I was reading your article.
Oh, so, sorry. Am I supposed to jump in next? I lost my train of thought there for a second. No, but it is, that is an interesting like idea as far as other games influencing your fantasy strategy. One game that I used to play a lot coming up was pool. Like, we had a pool table at my parents' house. My best friend had a pool table. And, you know, the biggest thing about pool you always think about is, like, hustling. And, you know, it's like trying to play dumb about stuff, but really, you know, you're good at the game, and you hustle money out of people that way. I've never personally done that because that is morally reprehensible. Yeah. But that's an interesting, I mean, as far as strategy for fantasy, I think that's definitely part of it, you know, playing like you don't know something, but really you do, especially like in Dynasty, trying to make trades with each other. That's something that you can try to pull over, just as long as you're not too much of a jerk and get yourself, you know, turned off, like your league mates turned off to dealing with you. You don't want that to happen. But yeah, so those are more of the game. Like, I've, at this point in my life, I hardly play video games anymore. And that's not to say, like, oh, look at me, I'm mature, I don't play video games. It's just, for some reason, that's just has kind of fallen off. But like pool and other sort of like, you know, card games, not necessarily poker, but like I played a lot of Rummy Cube with a group of friends coming up. So yeah, there's a lot of different games like that. And there's a lot of strategies that can apply to fantasy too.
Yeah, Matt, you actually weren't supposed to jump in there. I had my mic on mute accidentally. I wanted to ask Josh a follow-up question, and it got,
yeah, I didn't know
it got lost to the ether there. And I'll leave all this in because this just goes to show how unprofessional I am. But Josh, when you were talking about video games and specific characters or styles of play, was there one particular game that comes to mind for you that you could use in as an example?
Oof, that's a tough one because, like I said, I haven't been playing nearly as much lately. But I think about like RPG type games where you kind of pick a character and a class and different traits and really learning to pick one that you play well with, whether it's like a ranged character, a melee character, whatever it may be. This is getting super nerdy.
No, I'm right there with you, unfortunately. So, I mean, that kind of makes me think of, you know, different drafting strategies. Like, are you a guy who's going to take wide receivers early or running backs early or, you know, quarterbacks early in a 2QB league? That's a good application, I think. And Matt, to follow up a little bit on what you were talking about with pool, I think that trading is a really good example when it comes to that hustle. And this is something that I personally struggle with when it comes to fantasy football is I'm either too nice or too honest. Either I tell people, you know, I don't like this deal or, you know, I tell them why I don't think a trade is going to work between our two teams as opposed to trying to leverage, you know, my position and be a little shadier and say, oh, yeah, I think that this trade is good for both of us when I know it's not. I think that was an interesting point as well.
Yeah, for me, I mean, there are a lot of reasons that I don't think I'm a very good trader in Dynasty, one of which is, like, I was talking about this the other week on Twitter, that, like, sometimes I have guys on my team, and I just want to have that guy on my team. I don't care if you blow me away with an offer. Like, I'm not one of those guys, and maybe this is a stupid thing to be, but whatever. Like, I'm not one of those people that approaches it with, like, every player has a price tag. Like, I play this game because some of these guys I just want on my team and I want to root for them. So maybe that's a weakness, but anyways, I think that, yeah, you definitely have to kind of draw a real fine line of like playing dumb, but not hustling people. Cause like I said, you don't want to be a jerk. It's not like being in a pool hall where you can screw somebody over and then, you know, you fight or whatever. I don't know what the answer to that is.
A lot of that going on around the family pool table.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Broke a few sticks over grandma's head or whatever. Yeah, a lot of stuff like that.
All right. Well, like I said, check out the piece if you want. I'd appreciate the click. But we got Matt here, so let's move on from, you know, shameless self-promotion on my part and get into, you know, what the listeners really want to hear about. And that's wide receivers. When I think Matt Harmon, I think reception. I'm sure that's how it goes for everybody. And Matt, you're going to get bombarded with a lot of the same questions over and over, but we're gonna join the fold here. And right now the draft is coming up. We're talking about dynasty leagues for the most part. Redraft players aren't really going to start to tune into this stuff until after the draft, probably closer to July or August. And I wanted to ask you up front, are there any under the radar rookie wide receivers that you want to tout, or are there any big name guys that you think aren't necessarily worth the hype that they're getting right now?
Well, I'll start with some of the big name guys first. It's funny because back when I first charted these guys, it was around, mid season to the end of the college football season and up in towards the Super Bowl. So back then, this was when Tyler Boyd was considered, the consensus kind of 1.03. And then it's definitely, the tone has changed on him. He's more of a late first, maybe even early second rounder, which is a little more palpable to me. But I think that there's always going to be somebody that's going to take him higher than that. He's the guy to me that I never really saw that sort of status with. If you look at his reception perception, he has the second lowest success rate versus man coverage, second lowest versus press coverage. To me, I think that's a glaring flaw that he's not going to be able to get over at the NFL. It's only going to extrapolate because he's going to see better corners. And to me, he's a prime example of something that I'm really realizing this season as we talk. Sigma Bloom likes to say that the fantasy community is like an academic department where we all have these different methodologies and different approaches to evaluating players. And that's great. And it's really important that we all have that. And I know a lot of people do great work with market share. And one of the things that I've seen a lot of is Tyler Boyd owned this big percentage of his team's offense, market share, whatever. Same with guys like Leonte Crew. But it just doesn't really move the needle for me when that offense was bad, when it was a bad team and he was getting a lot of touches through that. So Boyd was a guy that I think gets vaulted up for that reason. But when you start to project him to the next level, he's a guy that to me, I wouldn't want him to be more than the third option in my passing game behind a stud number one receiver. And then, maybe a strong tight end or a really good clear number two receiver. He's a guy that I would want to throw to on third downs because he's got good ball skills, but not great enough in contested situations that it's a Mike Evans type of trump card trait. So I like Boyd for what he is, and I think more people kind of see him now for what he is. So I don't think that I would be considered a hater anymore. But he was definitely somebody that I never really saw it with. And some under the radar guys, I actually was just doing a mock with the guys from Dynasty Trade Calculator. I took Kyaris Garrett in the top of the third round. I really like him because he stands out from the rest of the class, that he is kind of a late rounder, but is a big prototypical X receiver with good athleticism. He had high success rate versus man coverage and press coverage. So he's a guy that I think shows the skills needed that you would want to see to develop him in the NFL level. He needs some seasoning for sure. And work needs to work on just over his overall game instincts, but definitely an under the radar guy I like. And then my other guy is Rashard Higgins, and he's not so much under the radar as he has seen his stock fallen from what was after a really just a dreadful combine performance. And I think now he's a value to me because he's a reception perception stud. And I wrote a piece about him on Backyard Banter, just detailing kind of the, never tell me the odds sort of feeling I have with him. I believe in my process, what it says about Higgins. And I think that he will be a future NFL player and in the right situation could really develop into a high end player. But at this point, it looks like a long shot. So he's kind of my other guy there.
Matt, I thought what you said was interesting about two things you said. One about Sig's point about an academic department and then the market share and how you handle market share. I guess I'm curious, just big picture, how much other ways of viewing wide receivers kind of calculate in for you, or how you take them into account in your evaluation. So if they square with someone as far as what you see in reception perception, or if they don't, is that something that you weigh in, you factor in, or how does that play out?
Well, the athletic testing stuff, I think, is very important to me. The age stuff has become more important to me. And I think that those two things really do a good job of opening what I would consider a range of possibilities. So you look at a guy and I think how that, and then I look at how that mixes in with what they do on the field in reception perception. So if a prospect is older and he has, you know, some questionable, like some maybe not the best athletic testing. I think of a guy like Michael Thomas this year from Ohio State. He kind of has red flags on both of those. So that to me like limits his range of outcomes. Like it's not, he doesn't have this giant high ceiling, you know, if that makes any sort of sense. But then you look at his reception perception. I think he plays that way. I think that is exactly how he is on the field. He's a guy that to me profiles as a long-term strong complementary number two receiver. So like that checks out. And so I do like to look at those other things. Of course, like I'm going to always default to my process because I think it's the best and most effective way to evaluate wide receivers, which is why I do it. You know, I'm looking at what these guys do on a route to route basis. And I mean, it would be foolish for me to think that it isn't the best method because it's my method and that's why I do it. So I'm, you know, to be honest, that's, you know, the reality of the situation. However, like that academic department sort of feeling, just because a professor, you know, approaches the subject in a different way or has a different methodology in evaluating the criteria, that doesn't necessarily make their method wrong. My method might have ways that can take a different path and illuminate different things that theirs does not. However, theirs can do the same thing, but for a different fashion. So it's all about taking in others' information, but trusting your process until you have reason not to. And I haven't been given a reason not to trust reception perception yet. And when that day comes, I'll look at it then. But I think that I don't shy away from, I don't like just immediately be like, nah, none of that other stuff matters to me because I think that's foolish.
Well, right. And you all can always compare your process to the processes that these other people are implementing to make your own process better, to have that sort of a litmus test between what you're doing and what someone else is doing. And speaking of your process in general, how often do you go back and look at older receivers, maybe not older, but receivers that you had profiled a longer time ago? And are there any guys, maybe from like a year ago or 2 years ago, that stand out as maybe being undervalued now relative to how you originally profiled them?
Well, I mean, it's harder to say because the series is still very young. You know, I first wrote a reception perception article in June 2014. So I haven't even really been public with this thing for like even 3 years yet. And I was charting a little bit before that, like trying to get the series ready for public consumption. But so there's not a ton of data to go back on, but there have definitely been some guys that I've tried, you know, that I've maybe not seen the progression that I thought I would see. Devin Smith is one that comes to mind that I really loved coming out of Ohio State. And I think that he could really have a chance like to be undervalued, especially if the Jets offense continues to progress, which God knows what's going to happen at quarterback. Would like to see a solution there.
Gino.
Yeah. Never mind. Like never, whatever I'd say about Devin Smith, never mind if Geno Smith is the quarterback. But so there's examples like that. But as far as like guys that have that I really liked a few years ago that haven't progressed, I mean, there's always going to be some. You know, like a Charles Johnson was one that I really liked in 2014. He scored out well for me, but then just didn't do anything really the next season. It was pretty much a non-factor. And I think that there's always going to be moments like that. There's always going to be guys like Andre Johnson was another one that was great in 2014, but obviously fell off a cliff. His reception perception was great though that last year in Houston. And there are certain things like, you know, learning the process, learning what it says. And I think that it can't really predict age curves or just, you know, flashes in the pans like a Charles Johnson. Like those things are always going to be a factor. And that's just like, but that's with any process. Like these are human subjects that we can't predict their entire range, you know, their entire outcomes for sure. So I can't really give a specific example as far as like a guy from a few years ago that scored out really well and hasn't progressed. But I mean, 3 years from now, I might be able to give you that example.
Okay. It's interesting you bring up Charles Johnson. I feel like I saw a tweet recently and I wish I could credit the person who put it out there. I don't remember who it was that said he was dealing with some injury last year during the season that never got reported. And one, I hate when that happens, that drives me nuts. But two, that could be some reason why he fell off. It could also just be agent speak to try and, you know, promote his client for future seasons.
that's one thing, like, I always joke, and the guys, like, especially on Draft Twitter will joke about one of the self-aware ones who actually will joke about things, joke about, like, you know, if a player that you like doesn't work out, the best thing you can always say is, well, the coaches aren't using him right, or he was injured, we just didn't know about it. You know, so, like, those are always the common excuses.
Yeah, I'm curious as to how you deal with – I know you chart, what is it, 8 games for NFL players and 6 games for college players.
Correct.
How do you deal with smaller sample sizes? Are there certain players you want to profile who don't have enough tape for you to do the full range of reception perception on?
Yeah, there are a few, and, like, Marquez North is a great example from this year. He's a draft eligible receiver who's really young, super athletic, but fell off from the Tennessee lineup entirely. He had 6 catches this year. So people have asked me about him. I'm like, well, I can't do reception perception off 6 catches. There's definitely not six games where he played enough. You know, that's one thing that you just have to go back and maybe you chart old games, but I didn't do that this year because I wasn't going to do it for any prospect. Like so I couldn't just make an exception for one. Or you go back and you can still go back and like watch their old cut ups on Draft Breakdown or something like that. But as far as like NFL guys that have made, you know, a certain impact, I try to set a limit at like 300 snaps too, because otherwise you're starting to get into like super fluky territory that the data doesn't normalize like it should. So sometimes I just won't even add those guys to a sample. Like Philip Dorsett's one that I would really like to look at this year, but I don't know if he played enough as a rookie. I think I don't remember off the top of my head how many snaps he played, but I think it was like in the 200 range or something like that. Or I could be completely wrong there, but like Albert Wilson was another one. And when he was a rookie that I wanted to chart. So that's part of having a process though, and setting strict limitations on what you are or aren't going to do. And, you know, I can look at those games, but I wouldn't include them like as these are full reception perception results, because I think it would skew the data as far as the league average and then also how that player compares. And it might set unrealistic expectations.
Right, and I know that generally you're looking at a bunch of different route types, and I've got a couple questions for you about those routes and what we can take away from that. Does volume or success in a certain type of route correlate to success in another? Like if someone runs a lot of curls, does that and they're successful in those, does that make them more successful at other types of routes, that sort of thing? Can you give me any insight there? It's kind of a strange question.
No, but it makes a lot of sense, though. I think one of the more specific examples that I've seen a lot lately is the curl or the slant route and the 9 route. And I like to separate deep threats into two different archetypes. And the one archetype I would call like the Mike Wallace branch of the tree. And if you remember Wallace from Pittsburgh, like he ran the 9 route and then would run those like crossers and, you know, Ben Roethlisberger would just fling it around to him. So, and I think that's the speed and overall just like unfair burst definitely helps them not only get down the field deep, but also just run away from man coverage underneath or knife through zones on those slant routes. So that's one that really highly correlates. And also some of the other like more nuanced ones like dig routes and out routes are some of the more advanced timing based ones. You have to really know when to like how to, for one, sell the vertical route and then that quick stutter step at the break point of the route and snap back in. So those are two that really correlate. And it takes like really good route running, like Jordy Nelson's level of proficiency to run those two patterns. So those are two that really highly correlate. I would say the one that like a combination that you see a lot of like of high usage and success rate in general is the 9, the post, the curl, and the slant. I mean, those are the super simplistic patterns on the tree. You know, guys like Corey Coleman coming out of Baylor, that's like the only routes he runs. But you see, those are clearly the highest run routes in reception perception. So sometimes you'll like, it's funny because prospects get criticized for not running the full route tree, but a lot of these NFL players don't run the full route tree either, or run those outside routes very infrequently because those routes are high percentage throws. They get players in space to make plays. And like, that's the objective. When you have a really good receiver, you just want to make it easy to get them the ball. And it's kind of like, you know, self-intuitive. But that's why you see some of those stud level players like the Dez Bryants, the Demaryius Thomases, the Julio Jones, like some of the best receivers in the NFL. But they run that really simple route tree because it's just advantageous to make it easy to get them the ball.
Yeah, well, there's that Malcolm Gladwell idea that the more you do something, the more of an expert you become at it anyway. So if someone's going to be successful at those routes, why not just keep doing them, right?
Yeah, for sure. And that's the thing. Like, it doesn't have to be that hard. You know, like football, it doesn't always have to be so difficult. And I think that's something that, like, I've tried to shy away from, those sort of criticisms of college prospects, like, oh, he doesn't run the full route tree, yada yada. Well, okay, but tell me what he can do, and can it be something that I routinely can have him execute on a regular basis in our offense?
So are there any individual routes that matter more to you for fantasy football purposes? We talk a lot about, you know, general football success and what makes these guys good at the game itself, but for fantasy, are there certain routes that matter more to you?
Well, I think I'll answer that kind of in two parts. For one, are they consistently executing the routes that they're assigned? Those four routes that are high percentage throws, can they execute those? Because you can pretty much be in any offense if you're running, you know, slants and nines. If you have a pretty decent quarterback, you'll find success. You'll find a role, especially if you are a speed guy like Travis Benjamin. Those are two of his best routes, and that's really, you can get by with asking him just to do that. So that helps. But then if you're looking at a player that's going to be paired with a timing based quarterback or a see it throw it quarterback, you know, kind of splitting up like who are they going to play with, then you want to look at certain routes. You know, Michael Crabtree was a great example of a guy that had a lot of high success rate on some more nuanced timing-based routes and was really good would be a great fit with an anticipatory quarterback, but wasn't paired with that guy at all in San Francisco and Colin Kaepernick. And then you see he moves on to a more ascending second-year player who can do more of those things well. And there you have it. He puts up a useful season in fantasy. So it really depends on who they're going to play with, like as far as what routes they're more successful on. But of course, like for fantasy, you want high success rates on the nine route. You know, some of those more downfield plays.
Matt, your point about Colin Kaepernick has me wondering. We have several reader questions that are going to come later, but one was about Broncos wide receivers and just your mention of Kaepernick not really being a nuanced kind of guy. As far as the quarterback position goes, I wonder if you want to share your thoughts just now, if he ends up in Denver, which is far from a lock, but if you have any thoughts on the receivers they have and how well they'd fit into a Colin Kaepernick-led offense.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty nervous regardless, because if there's one thing I've looked at in researching receivers over the last few years, it seems like every single one of the San Francisco receivers that I chart, I end up thinking like, man, if they were just with a different quarterback, whether it's Torrey Smith, who I just wrote about Crabtree last year, even I did Anquan Boldin's sample this year. And even him, I'm like, man, I think, you know, just with another sort of quarterback, it could be better. But, you know, Bolden's a great example of a guy that, like, it doesn't take a lot of nuance to work with Anquan Boldin. You know, you just rifle the ball into him in contested situations. He has, I think, the third highest contested catch conversion rate over reception perception in the last 2 years. I mean, we know that's his game. It doesn't take a lot of timing to do with him. And Demaryius Thomas, I feel like, would survive in that way because he runs that simplistic route tree. It's just about getting him the ball so that he can make plays after the catch. The one thing that would worry me about Thomas would be that he's never been consistent at winning contested catches or executing in traffic. I mean, I think that this was something that people didn't realize before this year, but I think now people understand it more, especially after that New England game where he had 13 targets and one catch and was just consistently beat by their corners and in contested situations. So from that perspective, I'd be okay with Thomas, although it's still a downgrade because it is Kaepernick. But Emmanuel Sanders would be a guy that would really concern me. And I like Sanders a lot as a player. I wasn't surprised when he broke out in Denver because he's another one of those guys that runs a lot of those timing routes, has the nuances to get open at very apt points in route, really understands when to break and how to sell the vertical routes and all that sort of thing. But, and that was not a fit at all in Pittsburgh when they were playing that Mike Wallace backyard style offense. And then, so it was no surprise that when he moves away from that style of offense and goes with a really timing based, up-tempo, anticipatory quarterback in Peyton Manning, that he succeeds. But Kaepernick couldn't be farther from that. So he would be a guy I'd be pretty concerned about.
That's awesome. That's helpful in thinking through this in-between period where we don't know what Denver is going to be doing.
Yeah, so you talked about Derek Carr versus Colin Kaepernick, and this is a two-quarterback podcast. Are there any other QBs, or not specific QBs, but has reception perception and your work with receivers changed how you evaluate quarterbacks at all? Are there any quarterbacks or quarterback types that you care more about in fantasy?
Well, as far as how they relate to receivers, like I mentioned, playing with timing is always a great plus to me. It's why I think I really like Jared Goff more than the field of the other guys this year, because I think he does have that anticipation and can play with a little bit more timing. And that's important because receiver is so dependent, you know, on the quarterback for his production, and then production fuels how the public thinks about them. And I think that if you're able to anticipate when the receiver gets open before he's open, that correlates a lot more to just strong production from the position. So that's something that I always look for in quarterbacks, but also just in general, how do they fit with the receivers that they're going to be playing with, and what's that going to do for them? So it's tough. Like, it really does take a lot of like breaking it down from individual traits and aspects about how they're going to succeed with the players that they're surrounded with. But yeah, I think that's one thing that I look for more and more is timing and just anticipation, just overall, like more of the field general sort of quarterback, not a game manager, but like I actually wrote a few years ago a quarterback typology, back when I was writing non-wide receiver things. And I can't remember now, I'd have to go back and look what I called that sort of quarterback, but like, yeah, that really sort of the field general, the point guard, like a distributor. I think a facilitator, a distributor, I think was what I called it. And I think that's the type of quarterback I really like to see, because they can make it work with a lot of different options and can spread the field and attack different ways.
I think your overall point that context is everything, that you really have to evaluate all these guys on kind of a case-to-case basis, is the big takeaway for me. That different wide receivers, different quarterbacks will affect each other in different ways. I mean, you gave the Crabtree example with Derek Carr versus Colin Kaepernick, and that's, I think, good advice across the board, is you have to not only evaluate the wide receiver, but you have to evaluate the quarterback that's throwing to that player. So let's move on and talk about our profile quarterback for this episode, Joe Flacco. The Joe Flacco experience is here, and we're all living it. Matt, you specifically requested Joe Flacco when I asked you to do the podcast. So can you give me an idea of what you like about Joe Flacco, why you expect him to be a more interesting or more valuable fantasy commodity going forward?
Yeah, I'm like weirdly obsessed with the Ravens offense, which I can't imagine myself saying too often. But there's a lot of talent there. You know, they have a good coordinator in Mark Trestman. Like, it's a volatile situation for sure, not only because of Flacco's injury, but some of the pass catchers. But like, let's imagine for a second, like everything works out for all of these receivers. They have, you know, Breshad Perriman, who I do believe is very talented, of course, did not play at all last year and with a weird injury, and like, that situation is definitely dicey, but again, let's operate in a perfect world. He is the type of guy that I think could dictate coverage and that you could feed 120 targets to, and he would make big plays in that offense. I think Kamar Aiken really came along as a passable, at worst, starting number two receiver for an offense. I think he's a good possession guy, somebody that you can throw to in the short to intermediate zones and be okay with. Showed some good ability in traffic. You know, they add Mike Wallace, who I know gets a bad rap and is certainly a player that is not perfect, was never worth the contract that Miami gave him to, but he's a guy that can play the deep ball. And as a number three or four option, that's fine. Steve Smith, I don't like the history of those players coming back, like an older player coming back from an Achilles injury. But like, again, in a perfect world, that would be a pretty nice, you know, third to fourth option as a receiver. They also have three really good tight ends at this point, and there's some injury situations there. But Max Williams, I really liked him coming out. Ben Watson played really well last year, and I do think he's always been an underrated player in the NFL. Crockett Gilmore showed some things last year. So there's a lot of options there to throw to. They have Justin Forsett. If he returns from injury, would be nice. Good receiver. Buck Allen is, you know, probably not a bell cow starting running back, but certainly a guy that you can get by with. So there's just an interesting level of talent there. They have a pretty decent offensive line, and Mark Trestman's a good coordinator who has a pretty strong history on his side. And again, Flacco, it's super, you know, volatile because he's coming back from a knee injury. You know, it's kind of happened later in the season, so who knows if he'll be ready. But again, operating in a perfect world, which we don't live in, but I still like, for the price that you're going to get him at, maybe if you are in a 2QB league, you he could certainly be, I think, your second quarterback week in, week out. And I don't think he'll be valued as a quarterback one, probably shouldn't be, but he was having a pretty decent season last year. I think people kind of forget that. Really, the first and fourth weeks of the season, he combined for under 10 points. It was abysmal. 0.6 points against Denver, 7.5 points against Pittsburgh in week four on Thursday. And I think people really remember those games, but he had 21, 20, 24, 17, 14, 22, 20 in all the games that he finished outside of those two. So, I mean, those are pretty good numbers, especially if he's your second quarterback in a 2QB league. I just like if the Ravens offense hits its peak, I think it could be really fun this year.
Josh, where are you at on Flacco?
Yeah, I think I'm right there with what Matt said, that it's the price that makes him really interesting. Over the last couple of weeks in MFL 10s, he's been quarterback 22, so he's going at pick 175, and that's an incredibly cheap price for someone who has a really reliable floor at worst. And like Matt said, there's a lot of reasons to think maybe this offense improves. On Twitter, 14 Team Mocker has pointed out that Flacco has followed a relatively similar career trajectory to what Ben Roethlisberger did in his early seasons. And so Mocker is making a push that Flacco is ready for a similar jump now that he has more interesting players and a more interesting coordinator. I don't know if I'm there, but my argument would be that for that such a cheap price, you have at least a floor and potentially an interesting ceiling with the pieces around him. So I would agree with Matt. He's an interesting guy this year.
I think interesting as a QB2 is where I land on him. I don't know if I'm necessarily going to be drafting him ahead of some of the other guys in that tier of quarterbacks. I kind of just don't care which one of them I end up with. And that's part of the issue with me. In terms of getting excited about Joe Flacco, I just can't do it. I think routinely he kind of finishes in that like QB 15 to QB 20 range. And there are a lot of guys that have that sort of appeal. You know, if Flacco ends up being the guy who falls to me when I need to take that quarterback to in a draft, sure, I'll do that. I have no problem owning Joe Flacco, but maybe I'm just blind to this upside that, you know, Mocker is seeing and that you guys are expressing. I am very curious to see how much Breshad Perriman impacts his, you know, fantasy stock. And Matt, maybe you can talk a little bit about Perriman. Was he a player that you charted at all pre-draft last season?
No, because I kind of mentioned this, like obviously the series is young, but especially evaluating college prospects, because last year I was not working for NFL media. So I did not have access to like the access I have now to all 22 film. Like now I can look up any of it at work. But back then it was just getting what I could from, you know, random sources or whatever. So I only came up with like 5 games for Devin Smith, 5 for Amari Cooper, and then like 1 to 2 game samples for Dorial Green-Beckham, Sammy Coates, and I think Kevin White. So no, I did not get to Perriman last year, but he was obviously a guy I watched film on and was pretty excited about. I think that he is, you know, if you follow me on Twitter, one, I'm sorry, but you know, like two, you know, my thoughts on drops. He was a guy that I think people really overrated his drop issues, quote unquote. I think he showed some natural hands ability, but was just a guy that would definitely lose concentration, maybe didn't always have the best timing with when to shoot his hands up in contested situations, but definitely showed some potential as a big play threat, as a guy that could outmuscle defenders and use his strength well. So I think like he had, you know, the ceiling of a number one receiver. It's just such a question mark now with the injury that happened his rookie year and just how weird Baltimore has kind of been about it. You know, like I don't even know if he's running yet. So it's definitely a question mark, and the move to bring in Mike Wallace was definitely an interesting sign there, like maybe not a good sign for Perryman. So I like the talent a lot. I like the fit with Flacco because I think he could be kind of a more physical version of Torrey Smith, and I think those two did succeed well together. But he's definitely got question marks on his side too.
Yeah, the Wallace signing was a big red flag for me. That made me think that they're not totally sold on Perryman being ready for 2016, and who knows, maybe we'll all be proven wrong on that, but that is something that's concerning for sure. Do you guys have anything else on Flacco here before we move on? Any more thoughts? I feel like you guys are both on the bandwagon to some extent, at least as a decent QB2 option for two quarterback leagues or super flex leagues. Anything else you want to chime in on for the average Joe?
I would just say that, like, I think that we mentioned the upside, like it's there. It's very theoretical that I could see him finishing like as a back half QB1 if this all goes well, or at least scoring in that range because there's just such a bulk of quarterback options right now. It's like I could say a guy's QB1, he might finish as QB14, but you'd still value him as a week in, week out starter. Yeah, so I mean I think that upside there, it's theoretical, like that he could be a little more than that, or at least be like for two QB leagues, like a strong quarterback two option. But I think at worst, like Josh said, the floor is there and is pretty safe.
Yeah, and I think I would say just last year kind of spoiled us with having so many late round quarterbacks turn into these elite wide or quarterback ones that history says we shouldn't trust that to happen again this year. And I think people are undervaluing the reliable kind of boring quarterback twos because they're chasing these really high upside, high risk guys late. And so I'm not convinced Flacco has all the upside, but I think he at least has potential. And so you can get him really cheap and know you have that reliable floor at a minimum.
Josh, just a quick follow-up. Do you buy into that idea that maybe we won't see as many late round quarterback values in 2016?
Yeah, I really think 2015 was really an aberration with what we saw just historically. I mean, if you compare 2014 and 2015, it's excuse me, it's night and day. And so I'm interested to see where the rookie quarterbacks land and what their ADP shakes out like, because they could be interesting. But I don't think that we will see nearly as much of the movement from the 20 to 30, like QB 20 to 30, moving up into the top 15 like we did last year with Cousins and Taylor and Bortles. And I just don't think we're going to be as wrong as we all were last year.
Fair enough. With that said, let's get into the listener questions. We got a lot, as will often be the case when we have a guest who is as excellent as Matt is. And the first one comes from Pete Aquaviva. He actually has two questions. The first is, what's the best landing spot for Carew? And Matt, do you care about landing spots? I mean, we've talked about how that matters with the type of quarterback in a certain situation, but specific to Carew, is there a team that you think he fits well with?
Carew's great because I think he's the type of guy that could fit on any team, because I think he does a lot of different things well. He's one of the better receivers at releasing from press coverage in this draft class, so I think that that's a really reliable trait that will help him no matter where he lands. So that's one thing that I really like about him. And he's also pretty strong in traffic. He needs to work on some of his route refinement. I do think his frame and overall, like not overwhelming athleticism will limit him to being like a number two receiver. I don't think he'd ever be your best number one wide receiver option, but like he's the type of guy that I think could land anywhere and he would be good. I think New York would be, like the Giants would be a really intriguing spot. And there's a lot of, I mean, you could slide almost anybody in there because they need so much help. They need so much help. But I think that he would be a strong option there. Atlanta would be interesting too, because I think he kind of presents some of that possession receiver ability that they got out of Roddy White late in his career. So I think that could be another one and would allow them to keep Mohamed Sanu in the slot where I think he most belongs. But Carew's a guy that, like, he can land anywhere and it won't be like, ah, dang, I think that's a bad spot.
Okay. Pete's second question is, in a first-year dynasty draft, where would you start going for the top rookies?
It depends. I hate drafting rookies in startups before the draft. While I do believe that talent is more important than opportunity from a dynasty perspective and long-term, I do think that you never want to draft a guy like – I mean, I know we have a question about Cody Latimer on here, and I'll just talk about him real quick for a second. Like, Cody Latimer has been a disaster especially for some of the hype that he got. But if you think about it, like, he went to a place that really was not filled with opportunity. You know, they had – two strong receivers. Peyton Manning fed those two top receivers, and they also had some functional tight ends there, here and there. They had a strong running back. Like, even if Cody Latimer had turned out, he would have been a wide receiver three that got maybe, you know, 50 targets or something in a season. Perhaps if he goes somewhere and gets more opportunity and knows they need to rely on him more right away, perhaps he ends up being a better player. I mean, that's how fluid these situations are. Like, there's so many if, ands, or buts that you can take with these players. So that's something that, like, opportunity is important in that sense, that I think that if it dictates a player gets on the field right away, maybe it helps them grow from just an expectation standpoint. I mean, that's totally just me theorizing there. But so that's one reason I don't like taking rookies in a startup before the draft. Like, I know I just did a mock, and I don't think I took any rookies in the startup. But it just depends. It's a case-by-case basis to me. Like, I didn't take any rookie receivers, but I did take Ezekiel Elliott in the second round of a startup. And I know that's pretty high, but, like, I think that's the type of talent that he is. So you have to look at a player's talent and think, can it supersede a bad situation? Laquan Treadwell's another one. I would start thinking about those guys, you know, just in relate. What I would do, my best advice would be place them with other guys in their, in the draft classes that have come out recently. Like, I like to look at, okay, these guys in 2014, where are they going in the 2015 draft, where are they going in a startup? Okay, do I view Laquan Treadwell as a better prospect than Devontae Parker? I would say yes, I do. And I think Parker's dynasty price is a little out of control right now, but where would I feel comfortable taking Devontae Parker? Okay, I'd take Laquan Treadwell maybe a round higher than him or something like that. So it's just basing on, like, similarly valued, what you view these players as, and match them with their peers.
Okay, you mentioned Ezekiel Elliott, and that actually, I'm going to butt in here with one of my own questions. I'll pose this to both of you. We're going to call this the Teach Greg to Play Dynasty question of the week. Matt, I'm not sure if you've listened to a whole lot of our episodes, but I'm very new to Dynasty. I'm still trying to feel my way through it. So I take every opportunity I can to ask smarter people like you and Josh to help me out with kind of wrapping my brain around Dynasty versus Redraft. And I know that Ezekiel Elliott is kind of the consensus 101 for a rookie draft. We know that wide receivers are generally more valuable dynasty commodities than running backs. So why is Ezekiel Elliott such a slam dunk at 101? Is it simply a matter of how, you know, talented he is? Is he just that transcendent of a player? Or is it more due to the fact that there are no truly standout wide receivers this year? Josh, you want to start us off?
Sure. I think it is kind of some of all of what you just said, that in general, I think dynasty owners should tend towards the difference makers, the trump cards, and it's on potential, but you can kind of see the elite talent. And so without even speaking to Elliott and Treadwell and the other players in this draft, you want to look at, for the 101, you want to say, is one of these players coming out someone that could just break the league? Is there an Odell Beckham, someone with that upside? And many, many dynasty owners missed on Odell Beckham, so maybe he's not the best example. But you want to look for that and say, is there one player who could just change the landscape? And so I think that's what people are seeing in Ezekiel Elliott, whether they're right or wrong. And it's interesting because Elliott wasn't the consensus 101 even just a couple of months ago. Laquan Treadwell has gotten hype for a couple of years. People that have been playing Devy Leagues have had him as the number one prospect for a couple of years running now. And Elliott really only firmly pulled ahead after, like, right around the time of the combine, where the numbers started coming out much worse for Treadwell, and a little before that where there was buzz he was going to be slower than people thought. But whether they're right or wrong, I think the tendency to want to find those difference makers and to really emphasize those is the right instinct, whether it's a running back or a receiver. Receivers are more valuable in general because they have longer careers. They're going to be they're going to give you value for a longer span of time and for other reasons related to scoring and roster construction, et cetera. But if you can find an elite running back, that is a valuable thing. If he is truly elite, even if he's not going to have the 10-year career a wide receiver might, you still will take that top level talent if you can get it. And so that's kind of at the general level. I'm not the most qualified to speak to individual talent. That's kind of more Matt's game, especially with the receivers.
Matt, do you have anything to add on that?
Yeah, I think Josh made some great points, especially you want to hit that pick. You want to try and hit a home run with it. And I think Ezekiel Elliott is that home run from a talent perspective. At least I feel like he is, and other people that are better at evaluating running backs than me feel that he is. But also right now, if you look across the league, like there are a lot of really good receivers. There's just a strong crop of, and I remember shockingly, I was on a podcast recently, and I know, right? I never do those things.
Which one? I must have missed that.
It was on the Overtime Ireland podcast, and he asked me prior to it that the whole show was going to be about my top 10 receivers in the NFL. And I remember I was sitting with Alex Gelhar, who I work with and I live with out here in LA. We were sitting at a bar, another shock. And we were like, he was helping me put together the top 10 rankings. And really the thing that we realized was that like middle class is really strong right now in the NFL. There's just, especially with the influx of the 2014 class, it's just so many good productive receivers in the NFL that I love Treadwell. I think he is a great talent. I would be comfortable taking him at 101 if Ezekiel Elliott didn't exist. I could even stomach maybe a Josh Doxton there too. Like, I think these guys are all really good talents. This is no knock on them. But there's just more of a demand for running backs right now. Like, my dynasty teams are probably hurting at running back more than they are at wide receiver, especially if you can make a savvy move to get some of those guys from that middle class. So I think it's a supply and demand issue right now, and I think maybe it's maybe the kind of savvy thing right now, as everybody is chasing wide receivers and emphasizing them, to take some stabs at running backs and hope that you land the next, you know, David Johnson or something like that.
Yeah, and as we see, you know, passing offenses get more and more prolific, And we, at the same time, we're seeing running back committees become more and more common from team to team. Finding a guy like Ezekiel Elliott or, you know, whoever else that can be that every down sort of player, that sort of value is alone transcendent in fantasy, whether you're playing in Dynasty or not. So that's a big takeaway. Let's get to the next question. This one comes from Chris Mitchell. He says, did you like Stephon Diggs coming out of college?
I did not at all. So, whoops, I don't know anything apparently, but yeah, obviously he was a guy I did not do reception perception on. And there's a few guys from that draft class that I kick myself that like, I kick myself, nothing I can do about it. But like Tyler Lockett was another guy that I wasn't really high on, that I think like, had I been able to do reception perception on him or Stephon Diggs, maybe I would have understood them as players a little bit better. But yeah, watching film of him last year and everything like that, I was not a big fan of his. His 2015 season was just really dreadful. I didn't think he would have any role in the NFL, but he surprised me as a rookie. I still think that he's not like a future stud. I think he definitely showed some improvement in his routes as a rookie and definitely fits with Teddy Bridgewater well. I think they still need to look for number one, but yeah, no, Diggs was a miss on my part.
I remember seeing him kind of fall off as the season played out last year to the point where maybe the league started to figure him out a little bit. And I could see how maybe even if you didn't like him in the preseason and he surprised you early on, that maybe the fact that he fell off kind of catches up to some of your analysis. So I don't know. Yeah, he might just be more of a wide receiver two, wide receiver three type than what we saw in those first few games. Josh, do you have anything to add on Diggs?
No, I don't. I'll admit to being very surprised with what happened in the Vikings wide receiver core last year with, as Matt has alluded to, Charles Johnson just kind of disappearing with Diggs coming out of nowhere. It really was interesting, and I'll be interested to see what that offense looks like this season as well, if it continues to transform.
Okay. Chris has a second question. He says, Matt, does your recent poor reception perception scoring of Devontae Parker make you shy away from him in Dynasty? I think you touched on this a little bit earlier, but do you want to expand on Devontae Parker at all?
Yeah, I seem to have created a panic in the Dynasty community about Devontae Parker, as I am wont to do with when I tweet these things out, apparently. Yeah, I wouldn't. I mean, I'm not freaking out about Devontae Parker. I think that, I mean, his reception perception from last year is very concerning. So I don't mean to paint that lightly. And like his score against press coverage was the worst I've ever charted in the last 2 years of doing this. So that is concerning. But that was something that I expected from him as a rookie. Like watching him in college at his final year at Louisville, he only had one move to get off press coverage, and it was all about quickness and athleticism with his feet. But you see, like, you can get away with that at the college level because you're a superior athlete to other guys. But you would even see savvier cornerbacks like the Florida State guys who were both drafted last year. They were able to defeat that move. And he had no counterpunch. And of course, because he got injured and missed a lot of training camp, he was never able to probably spend the time to develop other moves. So I think he's still very much a work in progress. But I am scared off of his startup ADP. Like the fact that he's already in the second round, top 24, I think, of overall of Dynasty, if I saw a tweet correctly the other day, that's nuts to me. Because you're making a lot of assumptions there. If you're taking him at that price, you're not only assuming that he's going to work through his issues and become a technician enough to become a starting consistent receiver, but you're also assuming that like Jarvis Landry's targets are going to take a massive dip back. And I mean, I definitely think that I wrote about this for NFL.com at the end of the season. You can't run an offense through a slot receiver like they tried to do with Jarvis Landry. You saw how inefficient the Miami offense was in general, and there's plenty of other examples from last year. But I also don't think that he's necessarily going to take this like massive dip back to 115 targets or something like that. What he does well jives very well with what Ryan Tannehill does and what he likes, the game he likes to play, that short, intermediate, dink and dunk sort of stuff. So I don't think Landry's going to take a huge step back for Parker to become a target hog in the long term. But again, those are more concerns for this coming year. So if he's a guy that like major media outlets hype up and he becomes like a fifth round pick in fantasy this year, I'm probably shying away in a redraft perspective that way. But overall, like none of these are issues that I think are going to damn him for the long term. But it's certainly something that I'm probably not going to buy in on, this major second year breakout for Parker. And so while I'm scared off of the startup price and probably what his redraft price will be this year, if I'm in a dynasty league, I'm not moving mountains to sell him though. So I will say that if I've caused too much panic, you know, don't freak out. And even if you don't own him, maybe the savvy thing to do is to, if he disappoints this year, like maybe try to trade for him next year.
Fair enough. Next question is from Ben Howell. He says, why does Julio Jones tend to not score a lot of touchdowns? That question seems anecdotal to me.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think Matt Ryan is never been as good of a quarterback as people think he is. But also touchdowns are random, man. Like that's, yep, you know, that's just the way it is. I don't really have like a great answer for that. It's just
Calvin Johnson 2 years ago.
Right. I mean, touchdown, like Mike Evans this year, like he played much better than scoring three touchdowns. So it just like that's the best thing I can say with touchdowns. Like it happens.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's about it.
Next is from Hunter Tenpenny or Tenpenny. He says, can you name a few wide receivers outside of the top 30 you see rising in coming years? So I'm assuming this is also a dynasty question.
Yeah. Torrey Smith obviously is a guy that I wrote about. He's wide receiver 76 right now in dynasty ADP. And I think that's pretty nuts. Like that's stealing money if you can get Torrey Smith for that sort of price in a dynasty league. So he's somebody that I would like from that perspective. And you know, in general, we always undervalue veterans in dynasty. I mean, that seems to be a fact. Like getting the old man discount is very nice. So he's somebody that like I threw a late second round rookie pick at the Torrey Smith owner in one of my dynasty leagues, and I'm really happy about that. So sometimes look for those, you know, cheapo veterans that you know, they're not the sexy young receivers that people are after. Looking at Rotoviz dynasty ADP, like John Brown is still wide receiver 33 in dynasty. That doesn't make any sense to me.
I love John Brown.
Oh yeah. I mean, huge John Brown fan over here. So he's a guy that I have him at wide receiver 16 and I know I'm one of the highest on him, but no way should he be outside the top 30 right now though. Like there's some other like super under the radar sleepers as far as like DeAndre Smelter. I like Willie Snead. I'll talk about Willie Snead. He's wide receiver 54 in RotoViz Dynasty ADP, and I love Snead this year. I mean, yeah, I think he's having one of the – he must have had one of the quietest 900-yard touch or 900-yard three-touchdown seasons for a second-year receiver of all time. Like, he doesn't get a lot of buzz, but somebody that I really like, he's in a good situation. As long as New Orleans doesn't spend, like, a first-round pick on a receiver, I think he'll be the clear number two or three option there in New Orleans, and – frankly, he played better than Brandon Cooks at times last year. So I'm not saying he's going to be the better player long term, but if you can get him for a wide receiver 54 price tag, that's great to me. I really like him. And if something ever changed in Kansas City, I love Albert Wilson as a talent. I love Chris Conley as a talent. Those guys are two that are way down there on the list that I think are waiting to be unlocked, but it might never happen because of the offense.
What do you say, Josh? Are there any low-level wide receivers that you see taking a step forward?
I love the Snead call. I have him on quite a few rosters. Another one that, because basically I'm just going to steal all of Matt's ideas, is he had earlier mentioned Kamar Aiken. That guy is also, to me, just criminally undervalued for what he's shown us already as a young player. And I think, Matt, you put it as he could be a real reliable NFL wide receiver too. And I don't think he's valued that way. So he's another one I've stashed on a lot of rosters. So I would agree with both of those, and that gives nothing original from my point of view, but I would just concur.
All right, next question comes from Tyler Bucher or Boucher. Apologies, Tyler. I still don't know how to pronounce your last name. He says, have you ever recharted any young wide receivers multiple times to find improvement? He's curious how much or if wide receivers develop in the NFL from a route running perspective.
Yeah, I have, of course. Like, there have been some guys I've been tracking over the last 2 or 3 years doing this. Some of the younger players, especially two I'll mention, that I think are getting better from a route running perspective. Dante Moncrief, I thought, was like a train wreck as a route runner at Ole Miss, but he has definitely evolved. From year one, he was really impressive, like in limited showings. His reception perception was quite good for being a guy that rarely saw the field. And then last year, especially in the early season, he was showing some really good nuanced comeback routes, some great moves against press coverage. I mean, that game against the Jets, I think it was week two, was awesome. I mean, he ran some great routes against Darrelle Revis, and he's a guy that I could see him taking a major leap forward if Andrew Luck is healthy for all 16 games this season. I mean, he's definitely gotten better as a route runner. And then the other one, I kind of touched on him earlier, is Mike Evans. Like, people think that Mike Evans had this awful year last year, and there were certainly drops, but I've already mentioned my thought on those. The lack of touchdowns, I already mentioned my thought on those. But from a route perspective, like, his reception perception in 2015 was better than it was in 2014. I think he's progressing in terms of a technician perspective, and with his size already there, I mean, he could really blow up this year. So those are two young guys that I think have gotten a lot better as route runners. And so it can definitely happen. However, it's not a given. And I think that's the thing that we get caught up in. Like, you know, if there's a raw, like, I've seen this, I don't think I've said this publicly, but I've seen this idea going around in some circles this year that, like, if you're a good route runner coming out of school, that means you've already hit your ceiling, or your ceiling is limited. And I think that for one has, like, there's no basis in reality for that to me. There's nothing you can point to that, like, says that's true. So I think that's just kind of just a weird claim to make if anybody is out there making that. But I also think that, like, it's no given that a guy gets better as a route runner. And I think that's the idea there, that, like, theoretically they'll get in the league and get coached up. But I think Ryan Riddle has made the great point over and over again throughout the draft process the last couple of years that coaches don't spend a lot of time on helping you refine your technique. They help you learn the system and get into your assignment. But as far as, like, individual improvement, that's on veterans, you know, to teach the younger guys that. And sometimes that just doesn't happen, or the guys aren't interested in doing it. But you look at players like Dante Moncrief, who got with a Reggie Wayne, and perhaps learned some of that technique from him. So it can definitely happen, but it's far from a given that it will.
All right, our last three questions all come from 2QBs.com's own Sal Stefanilli. The first, let's get into food takes. Why, Matt, do you hate peanut butter so much?
Well, because it tastes bad.
All right, next question.
I mean, it's like the smell of it, the look of it, the consistency of it, the taste of it. It's gross. It's just disgusting, and I hate it, and I will never not hate it. And just, if you disagree with me, sorry.
Is this a point of contention? Go ahead, Josh.
No, I was going to say I will 100% support this. This is arguably your best take.
You and I are the only ones, though.
See, I'm deathly allergic and have known since I was like 2 years old. So I have an excuse. People can't hate me quite as much, but you, I don't know. That is a very unusual take to dislike it when you don't have an allergy.
Is this a point of contention between you and Charlie, Matt? I mean, because I'm pretty sure that every dog on earth loves peanut butter.
Well, you see, Charlie has a very sensitive stomach. I never thought in my life that I would be the guy that has the little dog with a sensitive stomach. But here I am. I am a good dog father, as you mentioned. And I did give him peanut butter in his Kong, you know, that little red thing. That
gotta
they sit
have
there
the Kong. The Kong is crucial.
It really is. Distract them for hours.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah, I always, when I leave for work in the morning, I'll just go and hide it somewhere and be like, good luck, buddy. Have a good day. Find that thing. Forget about the fact that you're alone. But yeah, so I gave him Kong, in his Kong, I gave him peanut butter a few times. The most recent time, he threw up all over my bed. So that's my son. He's grossed out by peanut butter too. Just like.
Yeah, they really do take on the traits of their owners, that's for sure. All right, Sal's next food take question is, have you eaten sushi yet? Now, this leads me to believe that you've never eaten sushi.
Well, no, because when Sal was actually, which, you know, thank God I got to meet him. Sal's one of my favorite people on the planet, and especially in the football industry. He helped me so much at my start. I owe him so much. So it was great. He was out here in Southern California, I think, visiting family at one point. So we met up at Orlando City Walk here. So we were walking around, like, talking about where we want to eat, and he asked if I like sushi, and I was like, well, I'm starting to get into it. You know, I'm testing the waters, because I had never been a huge sushi person. Like, when I was a little kid, I was a real picky eater, and now I'm like a health nut with my eating. So, like, I was just kind of trying to get into the sushi thing when he first got out here, but now I'm really into it. I love sushi now, and I'm all about it now. So, Sal, next time you're out here, we get sushi together.
What's your go-to roll?
I mean, it's chalky to say the California roll, but I mean, here I am, you know, I'm in California, and it makes sense.
You take Ezekiel Elliott 101 and you get the California roll. That's it.
Yeah, right. And I am Mr. Chalk.
All right. Sal actually also has one serious question. He says, while studying the myriad of wide receivers you have for reception perception, did any QBs make you take notice of their play, whether good or bad?
Well, I mean, I don't see why this is any more serious than those last. we certainly looked over. I liked the Oklahoma quarterback, Baker Mayfield from Oklahoma. I just said that. because obviously watched a lot of Sterling Shepard, was a big fan of him and his route running and his ability to get open. See, he's one of those guys that people are like, yeah, well, he's already a good route runner. His ceiling, which again, I already mentioned is a bad opinion. But I thought Baker Mayfield showed some good ability to jive with that sort of player. So I'm excited to watch him next year in college. Obviously got a chance to watch, Sherrone Peak from Clemson, who I thought was kind of miscast in his role in the Clemson offense. They asked him to go vertical a lot, and I wasn't really cool with that. He's more of a boundary possession receiver to me, but I love the quarterback there, Clemson, Deshaun Watson. He showed a lot to me even when he wasn't looking at Peak. And the last guy I'll mention is the TCU quarterback, Trevon Boykin. I obviously watched a lot of his work with Josh Doctson, and I really think he gets undersold as a potential quarterback prospect. I think that he shows some ability to be not only an exciting scrambler, but also a guy that has the arm strength. And like, there's no reason he shouldn't at least be given a shot to work at quarterback. But of course, there's also like he got arrested for an assault or something too. So there's some other stuff going on there. But those are three guys that call my attention in a positive fashion.
All right, fair enough. That wraps up all of our Twitter questions. Thanks for, you know, taking the time on all those, Matt. I appreciate it. Just in general, how can folks get a hold of you if they want to contact you? Twitter handle, all the other spots you're writing. Give us all of the plugs.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at @MattHarmon_BYB. And yeah, I mean, obviously NFL.com, TheBackyardBanter.com. I still have some stuff going on at Football Guys too. So yeah, I'm always around. You can find me pretty easily. I'm always talking on Twitter. I'm on Twitter more than any human should ever be. But I, you know, I love talking to the people. I love it. This is, it's, you know, that's how I, people always say, like, I can't believe you take so much time out to talk to people on Twitter. It's like, well, man, that's how I got to where I am now. So I should probably just keep doing it.
Matt, you are, I will just say before we wrap up, probably one of the most humble, successful people I've ever encountered. So props to you for staying very down to earth and very humble about your rise and the great work you do.
Well, Josh, you give me too much credit, and everybody that says that to me gives me too much credit. I mean, I'm a guy that writes about a game about a game. So I don't see too much to get ahead of myself.
Well, it is appreciated.
Yeah, and to keep lumping on the praise, I really will urge everyone to check out the Backyard Banter podcast. I've been, you know, listening to it on and off for the past few weeks. I've been really enjoying it. I'm a couple episodes behind, but it's cool to get these kind of behind-the-scenes takes on how all these different fantasy football personalities came up through the ranks and found their way into their respective gigs. I just finished Denny's episode, and that one was – I was laughing out loud through that. That's a lot of fun. So make sure to check out Matt's podcast too. Speaking of checking out podcasts, we want to thank you for checking this one out. As always, I would urge you to subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever else if you haven't already. And be sure to leave a review if you can. We'd appreciate it. If you want to get a hold of us, you can always check out our work on 2QBs.com. I'm on Twitter at Greg Sauce. Josh is on Twitter at Lake2QBs. We have a Facebook page, Twitter account, and Instagram account at 2QBs. I think that's it. I think that's everything. Thanks again for listening. I plugged all of the plugs, man. We got to just cram as many in as we can. It's like a sinking ship. And with that, we go down with the ship on this episode. Thank you very much for listening. We'll catch you next time here on the 2QB Experience. We're out.